From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There are big headlines all over these days, but the one with legs, with terrible staying power, was the headline out of Antarctica last week. A huge ice sheet melting, big sea rise to follow. My guest today, former NASA climate scientist Jim Hansen, says we have to put the brakes on now on climate change or hand our descendants a terrible world. To hit the brakes, he says, we need a tax on fossil fuels, on carbon. This hour on Point, the Antarctic melt and the call for a carbon tax. Later this hour, ousted New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson speaks publicly for the first time about her firing at Wake Forest University's commencement. And in a moment, we'll turn to Jim Hansen, environmental economist Frank Ackerman, and more. But first, joining me now from Seattle is Ian Jockin, professor of Earth and Space Sciences at the Applied Physics Laboratory at the University of Washington. He wrote one of the two papers looking at ice sheet melting in the Antarctic. You can link to his article in Science at our website, onpointradio.org. Ian Jockin, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
Can you describe the scale of the ice sheet that is now apparently melting in the Antarctic?
Well, we're looking at West Antarctica, which is only about 10% of the overall Antarctic ice sheet. And that has enough ice in it to raise sea level by about 11 feet were it all to melt. Though our study just focused on Thwaites Glacier, which is about the size of North Dakota and has about 2 feet of sea level equivalent.
If it all goes 11 feet, and you're saying over some period, it could be 100, 200, or more hundreds of years.
For the particular glacier we looked at, it looked like it would maybe be somewhere between 200 and 1,000 years. And, of course, the rate there being very important because that kind of rise over a couple hundred years versus over 1,000 years is a huge difference at the rate that sea level would rise and that people can adjust to the rising seas.
The rate matters a lot. Does the rate of its melt depend on the future of climate change, of global warming? If we get warmer faster, will it melt faster?
Well, what we found in our model was the rate of the collapse was basically depends almost directly on how much melting is going on in the underside of the floating part of the glacier. Mm-hmm. So the more melt, yes, the faster it goes.
Is it clear that climate change is responsible for the melt that you see now and that you project?
It would appear that way. The winds have picked up a lot there recently for a variety of reasons, and it's bringing more warm water from offshore under the glacier and causing it to melt, and that appears to be related to climate change.
We've seen the word unstoppable around this. Is there any turning back on this particular expanse of ice?
You can never say never, but it does appear that the glacier, even when we dial back the melt in the model, still collapses over this, you know, even when we quite a bit over 800 or 900 years. Only when we turned it down to what seemed like an unrealistically low level did it not destabilize within 1,000 years.
And what about the rest of Antarctica with its ice, and for that matter, other ice sheets around the world, Greenland and beyond? Are they vulnerable to the same effects?
East Antarctica is considered to be much more stable because much of its, unlike West Antarctica, which is sitting in a deep marine basin, basically on the seafloor, mm-hmm. much of Antarctica is on ground that's above sea level, so it's more safe from contact with the ocean. Most of the melting in Antarctica is where the ice meets the ocean, not actually at the surface. But there are sections that do fall below sea level in East Antarctica, and there was some recent paper out by another group that showed that is potentially unstable, though it seemed like the time frame was much longer. And, of course, much of Greenland is melting away very rapidly, and many of its glaciers are speeding up dramatically as well. So, collectively, Greenland and Antarctica right now are raising sea level by about a millimeter a year.
Do you see this as the first of – is this going to be the future now? Every few years, we're going to get word from scientists that this ice sheet or that ice sheet is on its way into the sea, melting, and there's no turning back?
Well, we've been seeing for a couple of decades now, we've been seeing lots of glaciers speeding up and lots of thinning. So we have been observing the thinning. The key point in this paper was that this thinning is, in fact, a sign of the beginning of the early stages of collapse that was predicted a couple of decades ago.
Does that mean more to come?
Yeah, the rates in the model, it doesn't get better. It just picks up with time, the speed of that the ice is being discharged into the ocean.
You're in Seattle on the coast. We have much more vulnerable American cities on the coast, not to mention cities all over the world. As the results of this research came to you, Ian, what were you picturing in your mind's eye about the likely consequences for humans near the sea around the world?
Well, certainly Seattle's not nearly as bad off as a lot of places, but Miami, for example, and much of the Florida coastline would be lost with a meter of sea level, which at this point is sort of the kind of numbers people are predicting for the end of the century. So it will have a real effect on people in this century.
And you're going well beyond that. You're talking up to 11. You're talking huge effects on New Orleans, on New York, on Boston, many cities.
Yeah. We only modeled the glacier that had the 2 feet, but it's very hard to have that part of Antarctica disappear without affecting and bringing down much of the rest of West Antarctica with it.
Ian Jockin at the University of Washington in Seattle, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Tom.
Joining me now from the Radio Foundation in New York is James Hansen. The New York Times has called him the climate scientist who issued the clearest warning of the 20th century about the dangers of global warming. He's former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and is currently professor at Columbia University's Earth Institute, where he directs a program in climate science, awareness, and solutions. James Hansen, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
And with me in the studio, Frank Ackerman, senior economist at Synapse Energy Economics. It's an energy and environmental consulting firm that has looked at all kinds of climate change issues and potential answers. Frank Ackerman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Jim Hansen, welcome back to On Point. Here you are again calling for action and calling for a carbon tax in particular. Let me get your first year reaction to the news. I mean, it turned heads all over the world last week, the news out of Antarctica. Were you surprised? Do you see more of this to come, Jim?
Yes, I certainly do. But let me just say one sentence about this carbon tax. I do not favor a carbon tax, but we'll get to that in a moment. I've been saying for several years that the ice story is really the big story on the long run. And scientists tend to be conservative. They don't want to predict things without sufficient evidence to prove what they're saying. But, you know, we can look at the Earth's history. And if we look at times when it was a couple of degrees Celsius warmer, sea level was many meters higher. And this just has happened again and again and again. As the temperature of the Earth changes, ice changes, the amount of ice changes. So this is what puts a really low limit on how much carbon we can allow in the atmosphere. We've already burned most of the fossil fuels that we're allowed to burn if we want to leave our children and grandchildren a planet that looks like the one that we've enjoyed.
The cycle has come and gone again and again. You are among the many scientists, the consensus now that says this is a human-centric change this time. As I understand it, James Hansen, you're calling for a revenue-neutral carbon tax as a response. What do you mean by that? What are you looking for?
I call for a revenue-neutral carbon fee because every dime that is collected from the fossil fuel companies for this rising carbon fee should be distributed to the public. Not one dime going to the government to make the government bigger and to have more control over our lives. We need to let our competitive free enterprise system move us from a fossil fuel economy to a clean energy economy, carbon-free energies and energy efficiency. And that can happen if we put an honest price on fossil fuels. So far, we've been subsidizing them and not making them pay for their cost to society. The air pollution and water pollution, if your child gets asthma, the fossil fuel company, because of air pollution, the fossil fuel company does not have to pay for that. You do. And likewise, the climate effects, which are beginning to be apparent and costly, are paid by you or by the government, which is you.
Jim Hansen, stand by if you would for just a second. We're coming up on a break here, and I want to get Frank Ackerman in as well, if I may. Frank, you call it a fee, call it a tax, and people do both. Jim Hansen is saying fee, all right. But one way or another, it's putting a price on carbon that goes into the atmosphere. There have been many proposals about what to do about climate change. How important is this one?
I think that some policy that gets a price on carbon emissions is absolutely crucial. It's not the only thing we need, but it's hard to see solving the problem without it. There are many ways of doing it, a tax, a fee, some of the cap and trade systems that have been proposed. Many different mechanisms have been proposed, and the details of the mechanism are less important than the question of how high a price do we put on carbon emissions, how soon.
This has often been seen and has been politically in this country as dead in the water. Do you see new hope for something like this now?
I think there's more discussion of it. I think the climate problem is pressing in on people. I grew up in the Northeast. The New York subways never used to be flooded by storms until recently. Pick whatever measure you like. You see the climate getting worse. I think that there's been more and more discussion among economists, at least, of the merits of pricing carbon emissions.
How much time do we have to act if we want to put off the worst of what could come?
Jim is better suited to answer that than I am, but the sooner we act, the less the damages that we'll be stuck with, the less painful the action will be. The longer we wait, the more painful the actions that will be needed will feel.
The Antarctic has our attention. The melt there has our attention. And surging urgency in calls for steps to address climate change. Exhibit A, a carbon tax or carbon fee, maybe even cap and trade. Politically, This, in most of the country, has not moved, but politicians are all over the place on it. Maybe there is movement. On Sunday, in an interview on ABC's This Week, California Democratic Governor Jerry Brown warned of the effects of global warming. California's been struggling with drought, and we've all seen it, wildfires.
As we send billions and billions of tons of heat-trapping gases, we get heat and we get fires and we get what we're seeing. So we got to gear up. We're going to deal with nature as best we can, but humanity is on a collision course with nature, and we're just going to have to adapt to it in the best way we can. In California, we're not only adapting, but we're taking steps to reduce our greenhouse gases in a way that I think exceeds any other state in the country.
ABC's This Week helpfully bringing in the crackling sound of wildfire behind the governor of California. On the other hand, here's Republican Senator Marco Rubio talking with ABC News on May 11th. Not so sure about climate change as it's been described.
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate the way these scientists are portraying it. That's what I do not. And I do not believe that the laws that they propose we pass will do anything about it, except it will destroy our economy.
Will destroy our economy, says Marco Rubio. James Hansen, you're careful to say carbon fee here. People have said carbon tax in the past. Are you tiptoeing through this political landmine, Jim?
No, not at all. I'm making the point that you have to have a simple, honest system which encourages the economy, which stimulates the economy, not one that drags it down. There's a huge difference between what I'm talking about and a carbon tax. What I'm talking about is putting a rising fee on carbon, which you collect very easily. There are only a small number of sources, domestic mines and the ports of entry where the fossil fuels come into the country. You put a fee which rises slowly over time, and the money that you collect, you distribute to the public, equal amount to every legal resident of the country. That way, the person who does better than average in limiting their fossil fuel use, their carbon footprint, will actually make money. With the present distribution of energy use, 60% of the people would actually make money. But if they want to stay on the positive side, they will have to pay attention to their future purchases. And that's the way that we will spur the economy, because as that carbon tax rises, a carbon fee rises, it will affect everything. You know, the food prices, if you buy food imported from New Zealand, it's going to cost more because of the carbon fee, the cost to get the food to the market. The nearby farm will be favored.
That bottled water from Fiji would be a little more expensive than it is now. So you're talking about, let's say a tanker full of oil comes into port in the United States. It would be taxed per barrel or gallon of oil on that ship before it ever hits the market, Jim.
Right. You collect it from the fossil fuel companies at the port of entry or the mine at the first sale.
At the coal mine, wherever it might be. And obviously that fee would flow through to prices in the market. What do you imagine if all that money's collected? It could be a lot if this is rising over time, and you divvy it up between all the, what did you say, citizens of the United States?
All the legal residents of the country.
What kind of check might they receive in the mail at the end of a year?
By the time it gets up to $100 per ton of CO2, it will be $2,000 per legal resident of the country per year. So it's a significant amount of money. And that's why we need to have it going to the public, not to make the government bigger, not to allow new programs in the government. That's what the public doesn't want. We need to let our free enterprise system help us solve the problem. And we can do that. We have the best universities in the world. We have the potential for innovative changes. And we can then be leading the world in clean energies. But we've got to make it an honest system, not one where you give away the money to special interests. The way the Waxman-Markey cap-and-trade bill, 3,000 pages of giveaways to every special interest, every lobbyist who could write a page got it stapled into the bill.
Went down in defeat in 2009.
We need a one-page bill that says the money is going to the public, not to special interests.
Frank Ackerman, there are a lot of ways to skin this cat. Let's just look at Jim Hansen's for a second here. What do you see in the economics of this proposal? You've got somebody there ticking off how much oil is coming into the country, how much coal is coming out of the mine. They're levying a fee on it right there. What kind of effect would that have in slowing our use of fossil fuels? And how do you see the impact of it flowing through the American economy?
It depends on how high the fee is. One of the first things that would happen is that the remaining uses of coal would be really at a disadvantage and would be phased out even faster than they are being now. Coal generates more carbon dioxide emissions per unit of electricity than any other fuel.
Coal before oil, why?
The chemistry of the fuels, coal
would be hit earlier and harder than oil in use. Why?
Because coal is used to make electricity. There are many different ways to make electricity. Oil is primarily used to make transportation, and there aren't as many different ways right now to make transportation.
So wind or solar or others coming in to generate energy in as an alternative to coal?
That's right. Wind, solar, efficiency programs. Spending money on energy efficiency looks better if the alternative is more expensive. The higher the price of electricity, the more attractive it is to spend more money on insulation, on efficiency. Even natural gas generates about half as much carbon emissions per unit of electricity as coal. So gas would get a partial advantage. Efficiency and renewables would get an even bigger advantage.
Overall effect on the economy, we heard Marco Rubio say there, he doesn't buy that it's happening the way some scientists say. And he said if we go after it, we're just going to crush the American economy.
The studies that claim that are based on flimsy arithmetic, on assuming that environmental programs don't really create jobs. When the right wing has gone after energy efficiency programs, even in some very red states out in the middle of the country, they've found that it's impossible at this point to get rid of mandates to use renewable energy because so many people have jobs in the wind energy industry. There are some calculations there are more people working in renewable energy than in coal right now in the United States. So it will definitely change the jobs that we have, and some sort of compensation for coal miners in particular probably needs to be included. But it creates new jobs as much as it destroys them. There's no reason to think that it would have a big net effect one way or the other.
We're going to hear in a moment from an opponent of a carbon fee or tax. Jim Hansen, paint a picture for us of what happens here if the rest of the world doesn't follow. I mean, we can't legislate what India does, what China does. They may be ahead of us in some respects already, but if they don't go whole hog with this and the U.S. would, what are the implications of that for the climate, Jim?
Well, let me say that the reason I favor a carbon fee system is that is the easiest way to get international agreement. Once we have a carbon fee, we can put border duties on products from countries that do not have an equivalent carbon fee. It would be very helpful to have an agreement with at least one or two of the other major economic players, China in particular. If the United States and China agree to have carbon fee, and China is much closer to it than we are, then those countries would agree to have border duties on products from countries that do not have it. And that would encourage the other countries to have an equivalent carbon fee so they can collect the money themselves rather than have us collect it at the border.
One place or another it's going to be collected. Let me begin to bring our listeners in. Grant in Arlington, Massachusetts. Grant, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just on that prior point, I think our trading partners, if we do this fee, especially our poorer trading partners, are probably going to see it as effectively a tariff or a duty or a tax on their goods, which makes them less competitive. So how do we, for those who don't want to go along with this, how do we prevent a global trade war where they respond with retaliatory tariffs?
What about the global economic implications right there, Frank?
So some economists have studied this, and there are not so many industries which are both very energy intensive and very internationally competitive. And the sad fact is the United States has already lost most of those industries. Most
like
steel, some of the basic chemicals that have increasingly been moving to countries like China, like Mexico.
Right.
So the heavy aluminum production, for instance, very energy intensive and largely outside the United States by now. We have a few pockets of those left, but we have mostly already lost the industries that would be most effective on other grounds to other countries.
So – but what – nevertheless, the countries where those products are now manufactured or processed, made, they would presumably feel a hit from this, and would they want to have kind of – would a trade war dynamic develop?
That depends on a question we haven't talked about. What do we do when a country that makes steel without a carbon fee wants to sell it in the United States? Do we also put a fee at the border on the steel coming in from countries without a carbon fee?
Would you have to make this effective?
I don't think so. It would certainly be more effective if the whole world adopted it. But I think that the effect of this on the U.S. would be to push the U.S. into renewable industries, into clean energy industries. A number of European countries are doing quite well on that. Denmark has developed a big wind turbine export industry. Germany has remained an export powerhouse despite a huge push into renewable energy. There's no evidence that it would destroy our economy to go it alone, as in some ways Germany already has.
Do we have to assume that some countries would be holdouts on this? They wouldn't do it. They'd take advantage of the fact that they didn't have a carbon tax or fee and go whole hog with their steel and chemicals and aluminum and move further into other American industries that we still do have.
Well, if I could interject
yes.
here, I think that the border duty will be important on the long run for just that reason. You do need to compensate and make sure that we don't disadvantage our industries. But that's not difficult to do. In fact, the WTO rules can be read, and many economists have interpreted them as allowing a border duty in such a case as this.
Border duty, this is above and beyond a carbon fee. This is if you don't have a carbon fee, China or India or Nigeria will impose its equivalent through a duty on your products, Jim?
Yes. And furthermore, you can also rebate to your internal manufacturers the carbon fee that they paid when they export a product to a country that does not have a carbon fee. It's really quite straightforward. It may sound complicated, but in fact, it's very simple.
Yes, Frank.
We could do that, but it leads to a whole lot of complexity. Jim's no longer talking about a one-page bill, unfortunately, once we get into that. And the experience of countries in Europe that have taken the lead on renewable energy, that have higher energy costs than the rest of the world, shows that it doesn't destroy the economy. Look at Germany's economic performance with very high energy costs because of the commitment to renewables, better employment performance than the U.S. or other countries coming out of the recession.
Frank Ackerman, James Hansen, please stand by. I want to bring in a skeptical voice on taxing carbon. Marlo Lewis is with us, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, think tank in Washington, advocates for free market solutions, particularly in the energy arena. I should note, looking here, has received funding from a lot of energy companies, ExxonMobil, Texaco, Koch Family Foundations, and others, but has thought about this for a long time. Marlo Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be with you today.
James Hansen is looking at what's happened in Antarctica. So is a lot of the world. He's proposing a fee on carbon to get us off of fossil fuels, stop or try and put the brakes on climate change, and with that deter the worst impacts on the climate and places we live and foods we eat down the road. What about it, Marlo?
Well, let's start with Antarctica and sea level rise. there's been a whole lot of hype about this, including from someone that you had a little clip of earlier, Jerry Brown. His first reaction to it was that LAX would have to move, Los Angeles International Airport. What he didn't remember was that LAX is basically 120 feet above sea level, even though it's right on the Pacific Ocean. So even if we had 4 feet of sea level rise over 1,000 years, or even 16 feet over 1,000 years, LAX would have plenty of time to adapt.
Let's pull away from LAX because, I mean, that's one thing Jerry mentioned.
Time frame that's beyond the lifespan of Captain Kirk, okay? So we shouldn't get into a panic and think that we have to do something drastic right now or we're all going to be underwater.
So do you say climate change isn't happening? Are you in the Marco Rubio camp?
Well, I don't know that he said that. I certainly don't say that. And nothing that I said would indicate that I think climate change isn't happening. I think it is happening. I do think that that human emissions are contributing to it, maybe even the greatest factor in the last 50 years, as the IPCC says. Nonetheless, in my lifetime, and I'm not a really old guy, we've already added another billion people to planet Earth. So the world is not running out of real estate, and if we really have 1,000 years to prepare for a 4 foot sea level rise,
which we might, or 10 in 200, I mean, we don't know,
or even 200. Now, remember that.
So you're saying move New York, move Miami, move Southern Florida, move Boston.
I would say that the built environment, from the studies I've seen, most building stock turns over in about 50 years. And so the market adapts to this sort of phenomenon anyway.
Why go to all that trouble when, at least in Jim Hansen's view, we could levy a carbon fee and stay in Manhattan? It's got a lovely view.
Well, because Jim Hansen, I'm sorry, but he really thinks of a carbon fee as some kind of magic fairy. Because, look, the United States could eliminate all of our emissions tomorrow. We could shut down our entire economy. And if you believe the IPCC and their climate sensitivity estimates, that would reduce global warming 0.2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. This carbon fee that Dr. Hansen is talking about would do significantly less than that by 2100 and way less than that over the next couple of decades. So it's not like this fee will buy us any protection from a hypothetical rise of sea levels of 4 feet in 2 centuries or in 1,000 years.
Marla Lewis, stand by. We have to take a short break right here. I want to dig into that. That's exactly the line we're hearing from one camp, at least, on intervention with a carbon tax, a carbon fee, you name it. Marla Lewis, stand by. James Hansen, Frank Ackerman. We're talking about the melting Antarctic and urgency in calls to address climate change. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about that news out of the Antarctic last week and surging urgency in calls for steps to address climate change. My guest, James Hansen, says let's go for a carbon fee. Let's do it right where the fossil fuels enter the country or come out of the mine. Turn around and divide all that up between all the legal residents of the United States, and we'll be on a path, he says, to a better climate future and a better economic future, says Frank Ackerman, energy economist with us, environmental economist with us from Synapse Energy Economics. Marlo Lewis is here from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He says, no, not the way. Look to the market. I want to go to our callers, Robin in Asheville, North Carolina. Robin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just a couple of points. Point one being that I believe that a carbon is something that should seriously be looked at, should not be allowed to have any mark of any lobbyist on it. I agree with that completely. The other point, though, when we talk about, well, but we'll allow the free market, we'll allow private enterprise to take care of this, we've seen what occurred all along the Jersey Shore when we allowed the free market development that has stripped away barrier islands. We've seen what happens when we just keep it in the hands of, quote, the free market and private enterprise. And my other point is the fact that delaying and saying, well, but the science says that this won't occur, or the, you know, the waters won't rise for another century versus another 25 years, if we have any means as a nation to start dealing with the issue now, whether it's man-made, whether it's just...
Robin, we've got it. You say let's act, and we've got your perspective. Frank Ackerman, what about the free market approach to this? Marlo says, let the market respond as this unfolds.
There's a tremendous exaggeration of what the free market can do on its own. Some people have said the market is the engine of the economy, but a car really works better when it has a steering wheel and brakes as well as an engine. And the role of government policy in steering the economy has been important throughout our history. That's included government subsidies to fossil fuels. They've had a huge advantage getting started. So to suggest that now we'll just step back and, you know, let the free market take over, that's not the way important technologies are developed.
Marlo Lewis, so far, Congress has not acted on this, but let's say that they would. Let's say they picked up James Hansen's suggestion. There are others out there as well and said, we're going to do this. We don't want – they're going with Robin's impulse out of North Carolina. Let's not take this risk. Let's act. If that should be implemented, what implications do you see? What ramifications, Marlo?
Well, look, the Energy Information Administration of the U.S. government modeled a carbon tax that starts at $25 and rises by 5% a year. That's way less than what Dr. Hansen is looking toward, which is a $100 per ton fee. Mm-hmm. And they found that the average household loses $1,900 of income per year by 2016. And with an average loss of about $1,400 a year to through 2035.
What if the revenues from this tax? What if the revenues from this
way off? And look, he thinks he's arguing as if a carbon fee is some kind of free lunch. It's this great recycling program for money, and the government will just collect the money and distribute it, and everybody who's frugal will be better off. But what he's ignoring is that all people in this country don't live in the same regions. They don't have the same kinds of jobs. If you live in Washington State, where nearly all of your electricity comes from hydroelectricity, maybe you will, on average, come out better under his carbon fee and dividend
because
program.
Your energy costs won't go up that much.
Or if you work for an energy-intensive industry rather than as a software developer or as a professor at a university, you're going to be paying way more in order to work in your profession.
Marlo, hold that thought right there. James Hansen, what about that? People have different baseline costs when it comes to energy.
Yes. The statement was made by Marlo that this would not be effective. In fact, the economic models have been run. If you gradually go up to $100 a ton over a 10-year period, 10% each year.
Okay.
At the end of that time, it will reduce our carbon footprint 30%. It would about half of that in coal and about half in oil.
Okay.
So that's five times more oil than would be carried by the Keystone XL pipeline. So that just shows how effective it is. And if you do it in this simple way, then you have an approach that can be made international. You can't do it with a very complex system. You have to have a simple price on carbon, a number of dollars per ton of carbon, and then you can make it international and you can make it very effective.
Frank, let me put the assertion to you here. Marlo looks around the country, says this is maybe good if you get all hydroelectric power, so your costs aren't going to go up, but you will get the rebate in Dr. Hansen's proposal. But not everybody has the same baseline of costs. What about the inequity problem there?
So the idea of this policy is to cause a change, and it creates losers and winners. It creates opportunities for businesses that used to make money producing dirty energy to switch to making clean energy or be replaced by other companies that make clean energy. There's no way to cause change without some people's lives changing. And I think that thinking about the equity questions the way Jim has in terms of giving money back is important. But we're trying to cause a change. We're trying to change what
but
the economy makes.
But you're the economist, and what about the inequity? He wants to give one check, lumps, same size, back to everybody, but not everybody's costs would be the same under this. Is it worth it? You're saying just worth it for the change, Americans. Don't worry about that, those variations.
I think it might be worth looking at whether there are low and moderate income people in some parts of the country with extraordinary energy costs who might need more protection than the uniform policy gives. But I think that for people and I think there are particular industries like coal where we need a plan for the transition for the people who are most affected. But across the broad expanse of the economy, it's going to say it's going to look better to go into clean energy industries than it used to, not as good to go into other industries. The change will be gradual and
– But it would be a boon for alternative energy, you and others are saying. Bruce in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Bruce, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom and guests.
Hi.
My concern with public awareness of climate change is that it's happening in a relatively slow-motion fashion and that the symptoms are too disconnected. A hurricane, a flood, a tsunami is an immediate attention-getter for the public, but the effects of climate change that may not peak for decades or centuries don't come up on the public's radar, although they may make the planet ultimately uninhabitable.
But, Bruce, I mean, the severe weather events have been pretty fast and furious lately. Don't you think people are aware at this point?
Well, when I do discuss this with others, they seem to not want to rock their financial boat. I've even had people tell me that even if climate change is real, which I believe it is, they think that they'll be long dead by the time anything really bad happens. How do you combat a voting public attitude like this?
James Hansen, what do you say to that concern?
Well, that is a difficulty. The climate system has a lot of inertia. So what we're doing is intergenerational injustice in the sense that the impact on us is beginning to be important, but it will be much more important for our children and grandchildren. And parents have always sacrificed for their children and grandchildren. So they need to be aware of this. And I think that most people understanding the situation and realizing that a sensible system like a slowly rising carbon fee is actually not painful. It will benefit the economy. And by the way, there is a very rapidly growing organization, Citizens Climate Lobby, which is promoting this concept. And I think that as that grows, we can force our political system to do something sensible.
Marlo Lewis, we're trying to these are big, big choices the country has to make. They're not easy to make. We need clear information to make them. And we think about motivations. I mean, James Hansen steps up and he talks about his grandchildren's lives as a motivator. What are your motivations here? We've got a lot of fossil fuel money in your organization. Does that mean you're speaking up to defend their interests? And if how do we have confidence that you're not?
Well, Tom, I kind of make it a policy not to respond to ad hominem arguments.
Ad hominem, I mean, I'm just looking at your funders.
Anywhere.
Isn't that fair?
I think, you know, if you can ever find an instance in which I've changed any position I've ever taken my entire professional life because of a contribution to an organization that I worked for, then I'll pay you $1,000. So let's drop that subject.
I don't think it's ad hominem, Mr. Lewis. It's just it's an honest question. I mean, a tax on carbon would be tough for ExxonMobil and Texaco.
There are relatively few honest brokers in this debate. There are honest people. I'd say that an honest person is someone who tells you straight up that he's not an honest broker. I'm a dog in the fight. I don't claim to be above the fray and simply report what the science has told us, as like some people do.
So what do you think is so how would you describe the motivation if it's not science from those who, like James Hansen, who...
The motivation is that I think that economic liberty and economic growth are the best guarantors of human health and welfare that the world has ever seen.
What about our caller's concern about what we've already seen?
Schemes make people poorer. And just to say that you're doing it in the name of the climate doesn't make it any less painful. I mean, are you aware of the fact that about 70% of the people who live at or below the poverty line in this country have actually reduced purchases of food? 31% of them, this is according to one study that I've seen, have reduced purchases of medicine because of the high cost of utility bills now.
Hold the thought, Marlo. Frank Ackerman, what about this?
Low-income households.
Yeah, we've got it. These are tough things to do. We're looking at motivations, but we're also looking at a clock ticking, Frank.
So what puzzles me about the free market advocacy in this is that conservatives who talk about the free market often claim that it's very, very good at responding to challenges creatively, unless those challenges are environmental regulations. And so that this flexible mechanism, when faced with environmental regulations, suddenly turns to breakable crystal. And if the market is so flexible, as free market conservatives often think, why won't it come up with clever responses to a carbon fee, making clean energy alternatives look affordable?
If we need a tipping point, do we see it with this Antarctic news? What would it take, do you think, politically, to push this country toward action on this front?
If I can just repeat what I said before, which none of the other guests has responded to, is that even if the U.S. economy shut down tomorrow, we would avert only 0.2 degrees Celsius of global warming by 2100. So nothing that we do over the next—
Jim Hansen, what do you say to that, Jim? No point. Too late.
I said with the carbon fee, you can easily make it international. And that way, it's not 0.2%. You have to deal with the problem globally.
Go global and try, says James Hansen. Bring on the carbon fee. Marlo Lewis says, no thanks, no way. Frank Ackerman says, every way has its cost. This may be the best way to go. Frank Ackerman, thanks very much for being with us from Synapse Energy Economics.
Thank you.
Jim Hansen in New York, thank you as always for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Marlo Lewis at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, thank you to you.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, the first woman executive editor of the New York Times, Jill Abramson, now out of a job, speaks to Wake Forest grads. This is On Point. Yesterday morning, ousted New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson spoke to graduates at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It was the first time she had spoken since being fired last Wednesday as top editor of the Times. "What's next for me?" she asked the new grads. She said, "I don't know, so I'm in exactly the same boat as many of you." She spoke about the day after she got the news that she had lost her post at the New York Times.
Very early last Thursday, my sister called me. She said, "I know Dad would be as proud of you today as the day you became executive editor of the New York Times." I'd been fired the previous day, so I knew what she was trying to say. It meant more to our father to see us deal with the setback and try to bounce back than to watch how we handled our successes. "Show what you are made of," he would say. Graduating from Wake Forest means all of you have experienced success already, and some of you, and now I'm talking to anyone who's been dumped. You bet. Not gotten the job you really wanted, or receive those horrible rejection letters from grad school. You know the sting of losing or not getting something you badly want. When that happens, show what you are made of. I was in China recently, and as some of you know, the New York Times website has been blocked by censors there for more than a year. That means in China, citizens cannot read the most authoritative coverage of their country. And every time I reflexively tried to open the Times website, I got the message, "Safari cannot open the page," which made me become more and more furious. While I was in Beijing, one of our Chinese journalists, Patrick Zaw, was detained for hours by authorities. The government meant to scare and intimidate him. Why was he detained? Simply because he worked as a truthful journalist. So what did he do? He came right back to work and quietly got on with things. "I did what I believe, and that makes me fearless," Patrick told me after his ordeal. You know, New York Times journalists risk their lives frequently to bring you the best news report in the world. That's why it is such an important and irreplaceable institution. And it was the honor of my life to lead the newsroom. a couple of students who I was talking to last night after I arrived, they know that I have some tattoos. And one of them asked me, are you going to get that Times T that you have tattooed on your back removed? Not a chance.
Ousted New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson speaking yesterday at Wake Forest University. For a video and transcript of her speech, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Special thanks to member station WFDD for getting us the audio of Jill Abramson's speech. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.